Welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. San Francisco's homelessness problem remains severe, despite enormous resources and celebrated new policy initiatives dedicated to solving it. The city's Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing has a budget of over $275 million this year, including money spent by the police, the Department of Public Works, and other city departments. But the situation on the streets is still grim. Although overall numbers of homeless are relatively stable at about 7,500, there's been a 30% increase in chronic homelessness since 2015. Meanwhile, an astounding estimate of 2,100 children in our public school system have no home to go to at the end of the school day. And San Francisco's homeless problem now seems to be fanning out into new neighborhoods, on residents' doorsteps, at the entrance of our grocery stores, and in the parks, and even over to cities like Oakland and Emeryville. Encampments spring up and spread out, all a constant reminder of the moral dilemma of caring for our homeless and the consideration of other city residents at the same time. How can this beautiful, wealthy, progressive city have so many people living in squalor on its streets? Can the federal government help? And what is the city doing to address the problem? And where is all that money going? Tonight, to discuss the latest plans to tackle homelessness, I'm joined here in the studio by Jeff Kositsky. Jeff is the director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City of San Francisco. He's been in this post since June 2016. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also joined by Matthew Doherty, Executive Director of the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, which runs the federal response to homelessness. Welcome, Matthew.
Happy to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Del Seymour, founder of a job readiness program called Code Tenderloin. Del is a Vietnam veteran and was chronically homeless for 18 years. Welcome, Del.
Yeah, I'm real glad to be here, so thank you.
Happy to have all of you with us. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by dialing our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. What are your questions or comments for our panel? So let's get into the background on the homelessness issue. And Matthew Doherty, I wanted to ask you from the federal perspective to give us a little sense of when the homelessness problem from a national perspective started to really take root. It seems like many people attribute it starting in the mid-1980s. And is that correct? And if so, what happened to create this growing population?
I think that is when we started to see the modern form of homelessness that we see in the country really take root and become much more visible in our cities and communities. And a lot of it has to do with the loss of investments into affordable housing, changes in mental health care system, a variety of forces that help provide people with opportunities for living in our communities that no longer were present. And we started to see large-scale homelessness for the first time during that era.
And so how do people become homeless? Where do they come from? What are the sort of typical situations that would lead to someone into homelessness?
Well, there's a whole variety of pathways into homelessness, but really very many varied pathways. So some people just experience a short-term crisis. They may have a financial crisis, a loss of a job, a healthcare crisis, something that just means that the housing that's been stable for them, they can no longer hold on to. Other people face more significant challenges, people with disabilities, people struggling with substance use issues, people with mental health challenges that still, the vast majority of people with all of those challenges still remain housed within our communities, but there's some people who just struggle to hold on to the housing they may have available to them.
And you mentioned a few of them, but are there specific subpopulations that we tend to see more among the homelessness, like veterans or people with substance abuse problems?
So I think people experience homelessness pretty much widely represent everyone that we see in the country, though what's really apparent is the racial inequities in the experience of homelessness. And African Americans especially are vastly disproportionately represented among people experiencing homelessness, far in excess of the disproportionate representation of African Americans among people experiencing poverty. So there's a lot of forces that create those inequities. With the federal plan and the efforts that we try to convene, we really do focus on understanding the differences across populations, so targeting specific resources for veterans who have access to VA benefits and programs, many of them, but also some veterans who can't access those programs. Young people have different patterns of homelessness, different causes, different solutions that we need to mobilize. families with children. Oftentimes, really, it is more of an economic displacement that has occurred for them. We're seeing growing concern and growing presence of elderly people experiencing homelessness. I think what's really critical is that we don't try to just identify what the average person experiencing homelessness is like, but really understand the full variations and ranges and diversify our responses to reflect the diversity of people experiencing homelessness.
It sounds like some very distinct subpopulations yep. there based on what you're saying. Jeff Kosicki, I wanted to bring you into this since you focus on San Francisco as director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing here in the city. How does the what's the sort of distinctive characteristics of the San Francisco homelessness population? Does it differ in some ways in the sort of national scene that Matthew just described?
I don't know that it differs substantially from what we're seeing nationally. About a third of the people on the streets are suffering from substance abuse or mental health issues. We have about 20% of our homeless population are between the ages of 18 and 25. And we also have, if you looked at it as a bell curve, quite a large number of people who are 50 and older. We do a census every other year of the homeless population, and we counted 7,500 people on the streets. One thing that's notable about that is that 58% of them are unsheltered, which is very high relative to the rest of the country. But I also think it's important that we all recognize that's only the count for one night. San Francisco has about 21,000 people a year coming through the city experiencing homelessness, and we're able to identify about 15,000 people a year who are homeless and accessing some services in the city.
So where are everyone living? I mean, we know the people out on the streets, and I assume that's what you meant by when people are unsheltered.
Correct.
But where is everyone else living at the time?
Living in shelters or transitional housing or other programs that the city has for people who don't have a permanent home.
And would that also include potentially people just staying with friends for a night, couch surfing, that kind of a population?
That's a great question, because you brought up the fact that 2,100 children in the San Francisco Unified School District are homeless. The reality is the vast majority of those are doubled up or are living in SROs and not in stable housing.
Short-term rentals?
Yeah, that's correct.
SROs. Just wanted to define for the listeners.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you.
Sure. And then how long does the average homeless person in San Francisco stay homeless for? How long does that sort of situation last for them typically?
That's another great question. Unfortunately, we don't have great data in the city. Prior to the department being formed, there were 15 different databases tracking homeless services in the city. We're now in the process of merging them into a single data system, and we have a whole new process set up for assessing and tracking people who are experiencing homelessness. And if you ask me back next year, I'll have much better data. We do have good information, however, on the family side, where we're a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of moving towards a more coordinated entry system. And we're seeing families experiencing homelessness for about 14 months on average, and our goal is to get that down to 90 days or less.
Mm-hmm. And has this situation changed recently? We hear a lot about the opioid epidemic. Is that something that's caused an uptick, or have there been other factors that have caused an uptick recently in homelessness here in San Francisco?
Well, I think what we've seen is more visibility of homelessness in San Francisco. The numbers have been pretty flat for the past 5 years or so, but we're seeing more and more people setting up tents in the central part of the city. I think as we're seeing China Basin, Mission Bay, other areas getting developed where homeless people had been encamped, as those areas get developed, people are getting pushed more towards the center part of the city. There's also been a proliferation of tents, and I do believe that the opioid epidemic may not be directly leading to an increase in homelessness, but it is changing people's behavior. A lot of folks are using the tents as safe places to inject and are not as mobile maybe as they would be otherwise. But we're not seeing a direct correlation between an increase in homelessness and an increase in the opioid epidemic. We are seeing, though, an ongoing and really concerning problem with methamphetamine. And a lot of people that you see on the streets that maybe appear to you to be mentally ill are oftentimes suffering from psychosis brought on by use of methamphetamine. And that continues to be a big problem in this city.
So, Del Seymour, I wanted to get you into this conversation. You're the founder of Code Tenderloin, as I mentioned in the beginning, and also was chronically homeless yourself for 18 years. What was your story in terms of being homeless, and how does it kind of compare to what we've heard just from terms of some of the statistics around homelessness, both nationwide and in San Francisco?
Well, I've been into the person that was homeless due to my addiction.
So there are a lot of reasons. Just as Jeff says, I think our addiction percent, our addiction and substance abuse percentage in the homeless runs about 28-29%, which is also, I think, Randy can attest, that's almost the same figure nationally. And so what I did, I started Code Tenderloin, which is an organization to put homeless people to work, to get them out of the tent and into the workplace. My idea is I can house any homeless, any person, if we have a $3,000 a month income. You know, the reason why most people, I feel, are homeless is because they don't have $3,000 in their pocket every month. What we do at Code Tenderloin, that's what we do. So I more or less focus on African-American homeless because that population is one that is way out of proportion as far as our ranks. African-American homelessness started in the 80s. Also, the crack epidemic started in the 80s. Also, the closure of the military bases where hundreds of thousands of African-Americans in the Bay Area worked, the Richmond Shipyard, the Oakland Navy Base, the Oakland Army Base, the Hunters Point Shipyard. Everything happened in the 80s to the African-American population, and we have never recovered from it.
So a lot of factors that would have kind of converged at one moment.
All at the same time. And it happened the same in L.A. Douglas Aircraft closed in the 80s. Crack hit, and Douglas Aircraft was just adjacent to Compton. Crack hit Compton in the 80s.
And when you said, I do want to ask you more about Code Tenderloin, sure. But I'm curious about something you said, which is if someone has $3,000 a month, you can house them. Does that mean if they have that level of income,
He's very attracted to a landlord. He's very attracted to a landlord. That would not be the landlord's main reason to turn him down.
So, in other words, your goal is to take people from the streets and put them in a situation where they can earn at least $3,000 a month, and then they'll find housing on the market.
What I do, I take my students when they have a couple of paychecks on their belt. I take them out of Sunset, and I introduce them to the landlords. And that has never been a reason for them to deny housing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to hear more about Code Tenderloin in just a bit, but I wanted to go back to Matthew Daugherty first for the sort of national perspective. We heard some of the numbers from Jeff about the problem here in San Francisco. I want to ask you some of the same questions to see if you're seeing the same thing from the nationwide scale, particularly in terms of how long people are typically homeless for, if you have some numbers on that. And also curious if this problem has gotten worse at a nationwide scale. The opioid epidemic, other factors, Dell mentioned, economic changes, sure, and things like that are playing a role, that we're seeing new trends recently.
So when we look at the national data and the annual census that Jeff mentioned, communities across the country do that census as well. When we look at that data rolled up nationally, we're actually seeing progress. We're seeing a reduction in the number of people being counted during those annual census. So a 14% reduction in overall homelessness between 2010 and 2016. And for some populations, we're seeing a more substantial reduction. So for veterans, it's a 47% reduction between 2010 and 2016. For people experiencing chronic homelessness, people with disabilities, and the longest term or most repeated episode of homelessness, we saw a 27% reduction between 2010 and 2016. Family homelessness down 23%. So we're seeing trend lines that are actually encouraging that there's strategies that are working across the country, but we also see within that data there's a lot of variation. And the West Coast is experiencing some dynamics that are putting their trend lines oftentimes in the opposite direction. San Francisco's data has stayed relatively flat. Other West Coast communities have been seeing increases in recent years. We think largely driven by changes in the housing markets. So as economies have boomed in West Coast cities, housing development activities haven't been able to keep pace with that demand. More and more of the housing out of the price range of people who have very low incomes, people losing their housing and not being able to get back into the market.
So certainly, talk to anyone out here, they're going to be very familiar with this,
yes,
issue of high cost of housing. So is that not the case outside of the West Coast where you're seeing these positive trends?
We don't see as dramatic changes in the housing markets. In HUD's most recent worst-case housing needs study, which looks at the percentage of households who are severely rent-burdened, is worst in the West Coast. The Western region has the most worst-case housing needs. So I think the dynamics are more profound here. But we still see signs of progress that in even communities that are struggling with their overall numbers, when we see the investments into programs for veterans, we see communities that can make substantial progress even in very difficult housing markets with the scaled-up investments for veterans programs.
And I wanted to ask you about this. We talked about some of the subpopulations. Is there a particular subpopulation that seems to be more expensive in terms of trying to help them get back on their feet that might use the most services or require the most hospital visits? Is there a certain demographic that you can help for our listeners to kind of paint a picture of where the need is greatest?
Sure. So when we talk about the subpopulations, the focus on chronic homelessness, which is, again, is people with a disabling condition, could be a physical disability, could be a mental health disability, could be a substance use challenge, and they've also experienced long periods of homelessness or repeated episodes over the course of many years. When communities across the country have done assessments of what it costs to just provide emergency responses to people experiencing chronic homelessness, so police responses, emergency room, ambulance trips, a variety of costs that are associated when people are struggling with chronic homelessness, and then comparing that to the cost of getting them into permanent supportive housing with a deep subsidy so it's affordable to them, and an intense array of services, that the costs of providing that housing opportunity, which is clearly a much better outcome for the people themselves and for the community, it often completely saves the more expensive cost of serving people while they're still experiencing chronic homelessness. So that's a population in which there's the clearest economic case. But I think some of the other costs associated with homelessness for other populations are just a little bit harder to document or may be occurring in future years. And it's still a wiser investment to resolve people's homelessness as quickly as we can.
And Jeff Kaziski, I want to ask you the same question. Is there a particular subpopulation here in San Francisco that tends to be more expensive to have to treat their issues and try to get them back on their feet?
I think we see the same thing here in San Francisco that we see nationally. But I'd also like to add that San Francisco has also seen some of the decreases that Matthew was talking about. Since 2015, we've seen a 13% reduction in youth homelessness, 12% reduction in family homelessness, 30% reduction in chronic veterans homelessness. And from 2015 to 2017, we saw a very slight decrease in the overall homeless population, just less than 1%, which is nothing to cheer about. But I think it's important to compare that to L.A., which saw a 30% increase. Seattle saw a 16% increase. Alameda County, a 39% increase. And there's been increases in Portland and in Santa Clara County and almost every major metropolitan area on the West Coast. And San Francisco strategies have started to make an impact, and we're slowly starting to bend the curve. Really, part of it is by focusing on different populations. Youth and families have very different needs from adults and from seniors, and the interventions need to line up with what their needs are.
And the data you just cited, is that Bay Area-wide? Because some people have the perception, and I got this on Facebook when I posted about the show, that the problem is essentially leaving San Francisco and now coming over to the East Bay. Does the data bear that out as well?
No, there is no data to bear that out. For example, Alameda County, during their point-in-time count, saw that over 80% of the homeless people in Alameda County were living in Alameda County before they became homeless. There's no indication that folks were leaving San Francisco to go to Alameda County or to any other counties more than, you know, people normally do. There's a lot of movement amongst folks of all income levels throughout the Bay Area, but I don't think there's a particular trend has been folks are leaving San Francisco and going anywhere else.
And I also wanted to ask you about Matthew Doherty's comment that the high cost of housing in the West Coast seems to be a big driving factor for this. Would you agree with that assessment from what you see here in San Francisco, that this is to some extent related to our cost of housing?
I think there's no doubt that the housing market is the primary driver around homelessness, or not just the housing market, but also the federal and state and local investments in housing, where we invest money, for example, in veterans homelessness. It was a major push at the federal level. We've seen incredible results in terms of reducing veterans homelessness. But when you look going back to 1978 to today, and there's been an 80% cut in HUD's budget authority during that period of time, which is really corresponds with the rise of modern-day homelessness, I think we really need to think about not only the housing market, but how do our federal and state and local governments invest in programs that help make sure that everybody has a place to live.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Jeff Kaziski. Jeff is the director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City of San Francisco. Matthew Doherty, executive director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. And Del Seymour, founder of a job readiness program called Code Tenderloin. We invite you now to call in with your questions or comments. We'll open up the phone lines. That toll-free number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionsKALW. What do you think we should be doing about our homeless population here in San Francisco and in the Bay Area in general? So, Del Seymour, I wanted to go back to you. You mentioned Code Tenderloin, but before we get to that, I wanted to just find out from your own experience as someone who was homeless for 18 years, what did it take for you to get yourself off the streets?
Mine was a spiritual salvation. I returned to my religion, my church, and my Savior. And that's what gave me the strength and the courage to change my lifestyle. Mine was mainly my own decision to be living that miserable life. So when I finally got my act together, it was a fairly easy plan and step up to come back to the person I used to be. So a lot of our homeless brothers and sisters never had the opportunities I had before I was homeless to be able to go back on my skills. I'm a licensed electrician. I'm an engineer. I have a lot of skills that I could immediately fall back on, which I did. So it was an easy journey for me. I had been to the mountains, so it was easy to go back up.
Mm-hmm. And based on the experiences that you had, what solutions or truths did you learn about homelessness that enabled you to be able to start or work on Code Tenderloin and develop a program to help people?
Well, it's more or less what I shared with you before. There's several ways to get people out of that tent. One way is to send the hot team or to send the encampment resolution team or to send the Department of Public Works. I'd rather send HR. I'd rather put people to work because sometimes that's the only thing they need. And, of course, I can't employ every person in the tent. There are a lot of people with severe barriers who will never be able to enter the jobs cycle. But there is a percentage of people that we're able to. Recently, we took a young man out of one of Jeff's shelters, and he was living in the shelter, a younger man living in the shelter. Within 5 weeks, we have him working, and he's there tonight working at LinkedIn, and he's making $120,000. He will never be homeless again. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure that's just one of the examples, and you won't find every – I can't tell you a whole bunch of stories like that, but I can tell you a couple dozen.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to the phone lines. We have Jennifer from the Coalition on Homelessness calling in. Jennifer, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Sure. Glad you can be here. What's your question for the panel?
San Francisco, we're at this place where so many renters are very, you know, conscious and connected to homeless people because they're so worried about losing their own place. And, of course, the overwhelming majority of homeless people became homeless as housed San Franciscans. And we have this situation where the ground is fertile for and the visibility of tents and, you know, so much dialogue. And so in community organizing terms, we would say the ground is fertile to have really true systemic change in San Francisco. And my question is, you know, for both of the government agents there around, is why aren't they laying out exactly what it would take to end homelessness? Why aren't San Franciscans given an opportunity to look at, okay, this is really what is needed, and be able to come together to make that happen instead of kind of this approach of sort of hiding the need and you know, there's been a lot of positive stuff that's been done, but it seems like most of the time when we hear folks talking from the city, they're talking about how much they're doing, but they're very rarely talking about this is what still needs to happen, and this is what we need San Francisco to do to truly get us as close as possible to ending this crisis.
So, Jennifer, I appreciate your question, and actually that was one of the questions that I was going to ask, and, you know, I asked the speakers to give us some background information, but I'm very glad that you asked this question. I think it's very appropriate. And let me start, Jeff Kaczynski, if you wanted to address Jennifer's question. What do you think are the priority strategies that we have to do to try to solve this problem?
Yeah, I think that we lay this out pretty clearly in our strategic framework in terms of what needs to happen. We clearly need to add more exits to the system, whether it's more permanent supportive housing or rent subsidies. I think we need to be realistic about our ability to build our way out of the problem. We also need to be looking at how to utilize the real estate market in the entire Bay Area to find housing opportunities for folks. I also think we need to have a better coordinated system. As you pointed out, we spend $239 million a year in our department. We invest a lot of money in this problem. I should also point out that two-thirds of that actually goes to house people, not to serve people who are homeless. So most of our budget actually is for permanent supportive housing and other housing exits for folks. But nonetheless, we have to organize, and we are organizing better how we use that money and use data to make decisions. So as we've created this single data system, bringing together data from 15 different sources, we're now able to develop models that show us where there's gaps in the system, where we need to be investing. And I think we need to start making our decisions based on that information and that data rather than how we feel or what people's instincts are telling them. And we have that data, and we have presented in the plan that where we need to make more investments, primarily in exits for chronically homeless adults, as well as additional shelter beds and temporary places for folks to be while they're trying to get off the streets and exit homeless permanently.
So some of this that we're waiting for the data to kind of tell you where the needs are, or do you feel like you have a pretty strong sense of what the kind of key, you know, let's say three big policy interventions might be to address the problem?
I think we have laid out what those policy interventions are in the strategic framework, but I do think we need some more data before we know exactly where we want to be investing money. But some things have emerged for us. For example, one of the areas that the city has not invested enough is in prevention and diversion. How do we keep people from ever entering the shelter system? How do we keep people from ever becoming homeless? So we know that there's a gap there. We also know, as I said, that there's a gap in temporary places for people to be. There's over 1,000 people on our shelter waiting list on any given night. Clearly, there's a demand for more temporary spaces for folks. But mostly, we need to be investing in housing exits for folks, whether they're temporary. You know, temporary rent subsidies work really well for families and younger folks, but we also need to be investing more in permanent supportive housing for chronically homeless individuals who aren't going to be able to make that $36,000 a year, who really need services and rental support in the long term so that we can get, you know, the sickest and longest term homeless among us off of the streets and into housing.
And Matthew Doherty, wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to Jennifer's question about what the key solutions would be.
Sure. Well, I think the fundamental solution is figure out the housing opportunities that each and every person experiencing homelessness needs, but recognizing that some people who experience homelessness can resolve that relatively quickly on their own. When we look at the national data, the majority of people who access shelter services over the course of the year access it for only a very few days, exit, and never return to homelessness. So we want to make sure that we're still utilizing the resiliency that people have in their own lives to resolve their own homelessness and get stable again. But then really looking at the data that comes through a more standardized assessment process, identifying those people who need permanent supportive housing. I think the city will be getting to a really good assessment of how much permanent supportive housing do they need in addition to the supply that's already quite substantial in San Francisco and what they can forecast through turnover and through helping people transition out of that housing. And I think what communities are really learning more about is the rapid rehousing intervention that Jeff touched upon, which we have not been able to take to scale for most populations other than for veterans. For veterans, there's the Supportive Services for Veteran Families program. It provides that shorter-term subsidy with a lighter array of services that allow people to get back in the market and back on their path to success. Really getting a handle on the scale of people who are going to need that intervention compared to those who can resolve on their own, and making sure we're targeting the resources so we're reaching as many people as we can with the existing resources. But the fundamental equation is housing opportunities, and there's no other policy fix to homelessness than expanding the supply of housing that people have access to.
So thank you, Jennifer, for that question. I wanted to go to another caller, Dennis, in San Francisco. Dennis, welcome to City Visions.
Hey, thanks for having me on the air here. Hey, I have a question for Jeff. I'm a landlord here in San Francisco, and we've had a chronic encampment situation on Shotwell Street between 15th and 18th Street. And, you know, you're talking about data and everything that you're gathering. What do we do in the meantime? You have people who are camping out in front of our buildings, and our tenants can't leave their building, and their kids are afraid to get outside and walk, or they have to walk over syringes and, you know, prostitution that's going on. What are you going to do about that?
So, Jeff, thoughts and response?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we need to have meantime solutions, and one of those has been to open up more navigation centers in San Francisco. We've opened up five since the department was created to help people get off of the streets and into at least off of the streets and out of our neighborhoods and into a place of safety. We've been working in the Mission District for the past 3 months. When we started, there were over 200 tents and structures in that neighborhood. There's now fewer than 40. However, we are struggling with certain blocks like the one the caller spoke about. We're continuing to work really closely with both the Department of Public Health and Department of Public Works and the police to try to bring folks who are out there indoors into a new navigation center that we set up in the Mission District. And we're meeting every morning at 8 a.m. With the police department and our other partners to try to address these neighborhoods. Dennis, I know I get a report every morning at 7 o'clock as to where we've gotten calls around tents, and we're just going to keep working with those folks and try to get them to come indoors and then work with the police to try to keep blocks clear once we've cleaned them.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Jeff Kosicki, Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City of San Francisco, Matthew Doherty, Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and Del Seymour, Founder of a job readiness program called Code Tenderloin. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. And Dennis, thank you for your call just now. The number, the toll-free number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisionskalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using at cityvisionskalw. What do you think we should be doing here about our homeless population? We have an email from Denise in San Francisco who asks, has anyone calculated how many years the city has been funding solutions, quote unquote, to our housing problem? Has anyone thought the money spent yearly could have been put into housing of the homeless? For instance, buying a high-rise, converting it to dormitories. Has anyone been in my neighborhood where tents block access to sidewalks on the street? And she goes on a bit about some of the localized problems that she's dealing with. So Jeff Kosicki, in response to that, to Denise's email, you mentioned that a lot of the budget goes towards housing. But can you describe a little bit about how the money's being spent and maybe respond to Denise's question about what the city's doing and how long it's been doing it?
Absolutely. So for over 20 years, the city has been investing significantly in what's called permanent supportive housing, which is subsidized housing with services on site for people who are experiencing homelessness. We have 7,402 units of permanent supportive housing. That's more per capita than any other city in the United States, actually. So the vast majority of our budget, two-thirds of it, is spent subsidizing that housing as well as providing services on site. One of the new things we're doing, which is really exciting, is called the Moving On Initiative. We're trying to help some of those residents move out of that housing. We have a turnover of only about 800 units on any given year, which is clearly not enough. And we have 1,300 more units in the pipeline, which we're really excited about, but that's not enough either. So we're helping people who's in that housing, maybe been there for 5 years, been paying the rent. They don't need the services anymore. We're providing them with housing subsidy, housing choice vouchers are called, or Section 8 vouchers, so that they can move out of that housing and into the private market anywhere they choose and make space for chronically homeless individuals to move in. So last year, we had only 800 units of permanent supportive housing turnover. Next year, we should have 1,100, which will make a significant difference for reducing homelessness in the city, and certainly difference for those 300 people, more people who are going to get to move off of the streets and into a place of their own.
So let's go back to the phone lines. Lori from Oakland. Lori, welcome to City Visions.
Well, I am in Oakland. I'm not in San Francisco. But as you know, Oakland is having a horrible problem with homelessness. It is just epidemic. Huge tent cities have, you know, cropped up in the last few years. And my concern is, I'm a nurse practitioner, actually, and, I mean, these long-term goals are great. We get these people in homes, you know, get the mental health. God knows with this current climate administration, it is a very difficult task. But what my main concern is, just from a medical public health point of view, is the needs of these people in these tent cities and the homeless who are living on the street. There's no toilets, there's no garbage collection. You know, when I go to Oakland and see these block-wide tent cities or under the underpasses, like, yeah, we're not talking two or three tents, we're talking 20, 30 tents, and there's no toilets, there's no garbage pickup, and it's also giving other people free license to just dump their crap, excuse me, I use this place as a, you know, garbage dump. So it's not just the people living there. But that is one of my, like, what kind of programs are in place to kind of get the immediate sanitation together?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you, Lori, for that call.
I think that's a really important, pressing question. I wanted to let Matthew Doherty weigh in. Matthew, what is your response? I'm sure you get questions like this about the basic sanitation, public health of these encampments.
And I agree, it's an absolute crisis for communities, and it's a crisis for the people living in the encampments. We have provided guidance for how we think communities need to best respond to the growing presence of encampments in communities. And I think it very much mirrors what San Francisco is doing, that active outreach and engagement, building trust and relationships with people, and then really providing them with a meaningful alternative. And in San Francisco, the navigation centers are a great model for providing a meaningful alternative that's not just an alternative for where you're going to be that night, but is an alternative that actually puts you on a path to some kind of a housing resolution. And that's the strategies that we need to be really actively responding, not allowing encampments to just be neglected, both for the health of our communities and for the health of the people staying in those places. But it takes time, it takes patience, it takes partnerships across city agencies and departments, and it takes the ability to actually provide something that's a meaningful alternative and for people to feel like they're making a choice that's putting them on a better path. And I think that's what San Francisco is trying to do. I know there's efforts in Oakland to try to implement those same kinds of strategies.
And Del Seymour, I wanted to let you have a chance to weigh in on this question of sanitation, public health. What do you see when you're out there working with these populations, and maybe in your own experience when you were in that situation?
Well, you know, my idea on this is San Francisco, this is Oakland, this is not Yosemite. No one should have to live in a tent. I go out, I'm also the co-chair of the local homeless coordinating board, and so I go out on some of the encampment resolutions at 6 in the morning. And to go and see that tent with the rats, size of cats, jumping out of that tent, and it's almost like a thing where, you know, we used to have the 13 circus clowns would fit in a Volkswagen. And you can imagine, how can they fit that much garbage into a tent? It's unbelievable. And like you all, I think the listeners shared, in Oakland, what they're doing is people are bringing their household goods, their garbage, down to the encampments and dumping, because they know they're even paying the guys a few dollars, the homeless folks a few dollars, to help them unload their trucks of this. So, and they're just making the picture look bad on the homeless folks. But we should be able to provide, you know, my idea is that every one of the people in the tent is a citizen of Oakland or a citizen of San Francisco or a citizen of San Jose. To be a citizen of a city, you are promised you have a right to have sewage and water. And we haven't been able to do that yet. And I think that would be a really step up of our game if we can at least provide those basic things to our homeless brothers and sisters, because every one of them is a citizen of our city.
And do you think these encampments should be taken down?
Oh, I most certainly do, yes. I most certainly do.
And when you see these sweeps that come through, do you think they're helping or hurting the people who live there?
Well, what do you mean by sweeps? I've never seen a sweep.
Well, maybe Matthew Doherty, you can weigh in on some of the national responses to these types of encampments.
And what we focus on is trying to create solutions to encampments, not taking them down, not sweeping them away. That simply moving people from one place to another doesn't get us anywhere as a community as a whole. So it really is the purposeful engagement of people, the provision of meaningful alternatives, helping people keep a more sanitary environment if we don't have a place to put them yet, so allowing people to move their possessions, to clean the area and allow people to be there. But ultimately, we do want to see real resolutions, but not taking down. Taking down tends to imply coming in, moving people, seizing possessions. That's absolutely counterproductive. It's expensive, and it breaks the trust that you're trying to build with people so that you can actually help them to access the assistance you have for them.
And Jeff Kosicki is just on the subject of removing some of these encampments. Where do people tend to go after these removal operations have been carried out?
Yeah, we have resolved 19 large encampments during the past 13 or 14 months or so. 70% of the people who we offered a place of safety to have accepted those, and that's navigation centers, shelters. Some people have gone directly into residential treatment programs. Some have gone directly into housing, actually. And then there are some folks who, you know, we haven't offered them something that's meaningful to them, or they've made a decision to not accept what we're offering that time. But I think our approach has been much more effective than just coming in and, you know, sweeping people off the streets, just telling everybody they have to leave, take your tent down, or we're going to take your tent away from you, because they're just going to end up somewhere else. So we've been fairly successful at this. We just need to keep trying and keep trying to find ways to engage people in a way that's meaningful to them. The navigation center really is a response to the fact that the shelter system doesn't work for a lot of people. There's too many people there. They don't do well with the rules about when you can come in and when you can leave in the navigation center, and they can't bring their pets or can't come in with their partners. So that was our way of figuring out, you know, how can we encourage people to come inside and create a meaningful opportunity that works for them.
So definitely want to talk more about navigation centers in just a moment. But first, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're joined tonight by Jeff Kositsky, Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for San Francisco, Matthew Doherty, Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and Del Seymour, founder of the job readiness program Code Tenderloin. We invite you to continue to call in with questions or comments. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So, Jeff, you were just describing navigation centers, and Del Seymour, I wanted to ask you about navigation centers. They've been hailed as successful, but curious if you could just talk a little bit about what you – first of all, if you could just describe them and what you think should be happening at them.
Well, navigation center was a concept developed a couple of years ago here, started here in San Francisco, and one of their basic premises of the navigation center was the word navigation. We would bring people in from the outside and bring all the exterior services to them. For example, if you yourself was in the shelter and I asked you to go to Social Security, to the VA, and a couple other places, DMV, you would probably do it within a couple hours. A lot of our homeless neighbors don't have that dexterity or ability to do that. They would take days, sometimes week, or not at all. So the concept was to bring those services into the navigation center where they could walk 10 feet and start their road to removing barriers to them being in that navigation center. Mm-hmm. The city of San Francisco just opened up a newer one on the waterfront that it looks like a lodge somewhere up in the resort areas. It looks like a resort. And I'm not putting too much on it. It looks like a resort. It's all redwood and all. So, I mean, it's a wonderful place. You can bring your pets. You know, most of our homeless in San Francisco have at least two pit bulls. So it's a place you can bring your pets. You can bring your partner. A lot of reasons for a person not wanting to get off the street because they're going to take his girl to a different building than him or his or her guy to a different building. These couples don't want to split up. You don't want to split up. You wouldn't want to split up with your other half. So why do we make them do it? So the navigation center gets rid of that barrier. And also their possessions. Homeless people have a lot of stuff. That's what they are. They got a lot of stuff. Because when you can't have a car, you can't have a widescreen TV, you just start collecting stuff. Like we do in our houses, we collect stuff. We call it furniture, but we collect stuff. So this gives them a chance to bring their stuff with them. We try to talk them into downsizing, but at the end of the day, they're allowed to bring their stuff in. And this is the reason why a lot of people didn't accept our shelters before. People say, well, hey, that guy really wants to be homeless. No, he don't. I've never met that guy. The guy doesn't want to accept the options that we give them. So now we're able to give them better options, and we're getting more people to say yes.
And do you think anything needs to be done differently than what's being done now with the navigation centers?
We need a whole bunch more.
Okay. And I assume, Jeff, you might agree with that?
Well, I do agree with that. But the issue with navigation centers that we all have to remember is they don't house people. Housing houses people. So we certainly need to add navigation centers, but at the same time, we don't want them to all be each one of those beds to be a dead end for the person that's there. So we have to find additional ways to house people, whether it's through permanent housing or temporary rent subsidies. We really need to balance what we do in terms of how we invest our funds. So yes to more NAV centers, but a double yes to more housing exits.
Well, and on that point, we have an email from Anna Marie who says she would love to hear a realistic solution. College-educated, working young adults cannot afford housing in San Francisco, many teachers too. So who's going to pay for housing for them and for others? So, Jeff, on this point, do you have a response to that question about where the money's going to come from realistically? Yeah.
I mean, I think this is a huge challenge. Like, where's the housing going to come from? You know, my wife is a teacher here in the San Francisco Unified School District, and so many of her colleagues can't live in the city anymore. And I think that we need help at the state level, and we need help at the federal level. You know, Matthew Desmond, in his outstanding book, Evicted, talks about the need for a universal housing subsidy for all Americans that cannot afford to remain stably housed. And I think we're never going to end homelessness until we get the kind of support we need from the federal and state governments, because this isn't just a San Francisco problem or a Bay Area problem. It's a national problem, and we have to find ways to make our housing market work better, whether it's through changing laws like we've recently done in California to help speed up the construction of housing. But I think it's also about how do you make that housing affordable for folks. We currently spend six times more subsidizing home ownership through mortgage interest tax deductions and through capital gains exclusions than we spend on subsidizing rental housing for low-income folks. And we really need to change those dynamics here in the Bay Area, but nationwide.
So Matthew Doherty, Jeff just mentioned that we need federal help. So you're representing the federal government here. What is your response to what the federal government could do to help this local problem?
Sure. Well, I think it's always going to have to be a partnership of federal, state, and local resources. And I'll be honest, I don't think we're going to be on a path to scale up federal investments into affordable housing in the short term. So I think we're going to have to rely more on state and local sources. There's some really promising steps forward taken by the state of California through the last legislative cycle to start to generate state-level resources that then can be brought into local communities, oftentimes leveraged with local resources, that is going to create the opportunity to create more of a pipeline of units. I think fundamentally, we also all need to recognize that we need to scale up housing development at all affordability levels and to accept more density into our neighborhoods, to accept affordable housing developments into our neighborhoods, that we all have to be neighborhoods that are accepting of growth and development, because you cannot create more housing opportunities and reject growth and development at the same time.
Well, it seems like so many of these housing issues boil down to neighborhood opposition. You know, no one wants to live next to a new market rate high rise, let alone a high rise for formerly homeless people once they have a home in these buildings. So, Jeff, I mean, how do we overcome that dynamic? That seems to be so much at the root of all the issues that we're describing here in terms of the housing situation.
I mean, I think it's an issue. I don't think it's the issue. And I will say that just takes outreach and education. I've helped develop a lot of affordable housing for homeless people here in San Francisco when I was with the Community Housing Partnership. And certainly we had opposition, but more often than not, I always felt like the majority of people supported what we were doing. And we opened up housing in Hayes Valley, in Cal Hollow, on Treasure Island, in Trans Bay, all over the city. And there were some people for it. There were some people against it. Same thing with the Navigation Center on Van Ness Street. There were some people who were very, very concerned about it. And I happened to live in that neighborhood, and it was there was definitely some very vocal opposition. But I would say at the community meetings, the vast majority of people were supportive because they don't want to see their brothers and sisters and their neighbors suffering out on the streets. Of course, they'd rather have them. Dell talks about, do you want somebody sleeping, on the side of the building or inside the building? And Lennar was a great partner and opened up that facility to allow us to use it temporarily while they're getting ready to develop it into housing. And in the meantime, we've got 120 people who used to be camped out around that building now indoors. Everybody's happier. And I think we've gotten good support. And when we go to other neighborhoods, we'll be able to show some of these successes and encourage people to welcome them into their neighborhood as well.
And so on the phone lines, we have Joanne from San Francisco. Joanne, welcome to City Visions.
Oh, thank you. This is Joanne.
Yes. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to City Visions. What's your question for the panel tonight?
Okay, well, I'm just going to pick one, although I'm empathetic to the other ones that I've experienced, all of them. But one that is bothering me the most is that when a person who is older, a senior, or disabled, and we work at a minimum wage job, say for me, I work 5 hours a week, there's a formula. The formula is you can keep the first $60, and then after that, they take 50% of the gross, and then the deductions from the whole amount are subtracted from that remainder, and then if you're in one of the subsidized housing,
okay,
increase your rent by one third.
Joanna, sounds like just challenges about kind of dealing with the different programs and for people with minimum wage or part-time jobs. Matthew Doherty, do you want to weigh in?
Sure. I don't know that I could follow the specifics of that situation, but there definitely are challenges as people are trying to reengage in the workforce if they may be receiving Social Security, Supplemental Security Income benefits or SSDI benefits, that there is a formula that I think it's fair to ask the questions, are we incentivizing employment or not? There definitely is impact on rent levels within subsidized housing programs when people's income grows, though there are some programs that allow people to put the increase into savings to help support their ability perhaps to move on from that housing at some point in the future. I think we have to be looking at this full range of policy interventions and strongly believe that we should be incentivizing employment opportunities and getting people reengaged in the workforce, either on a part-time or full-time basis, as much as we can. So I think fair issues that we should be looking at more closely.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Joanne, for that question. We have an email from Lisa in San Francisco who asks, what do you think of the $25 voucher you can give to the homeless? Are they good to buy for them? Can the vouchers work in navigation centers? So, Del, do you have a response to people ask about vouchers?
Right. I presume she's talking about the hand-up vouchers. Which I have a couple in my pocket right now. I have them out. I'm very selective to who I give them to because I give them to people that I know needs to go into one of our resource centers to see how they can be assisted further. So it's a great incentive to get someone to go in. And, you know, that's what we don't do enough of. It's incentivize people. You know, you and I go to work every day for a reason. We get a paycheck at the end of the week. We probably, well, at least I wouldn't go to work if I didn't get a paycheck. The same with homeless people. They won't, a lot of them will not do anything unless they're incentivized because they're in their comfort zone. You take them out of their comfort zone to get them to walk 6 blocks somewhere, give them something. And that's what the hand-up card does. The hand-up card can be exchanged for a Visa card where you can Visa card or specialized card such as a CVS card, a Metro PCS card, or whatever you might need. So they have come in handy. It's helped. I've been getting them out for like the last year or so. Hand-up actually subsidizes and gives them to me because they know I'm in the communities. Mm-hmm. So they work well.
And how do you get these vouchers?
You can get in touch with Hand-up and you can actually buy them. At certain times of the year, a few of the tech companies will actually subsidize 50% of the purchase price.
And is that your sort of recommended way for the members of the public who walk by someone who's homeless on the street to support them? I mean, would you recommend someone gives a panhandler, you know, a dollar, or would you prefer they?
Well, we really don't use the word panhandle, but I encourage people to go by your own conscience. If you want to give a guy a dollar, give him a dollar. If you want to give him $5, if he says he needs a dollar for a drink, give him the doggone dollar. Because you wouldn't turn your buddy down if he asks you, buy him a damn drink. No big deal.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to the phone lines. We have Marta in San Francisco.
Hello. Yeah, my name is Marta. I live in San Francisco. I live between 8 and 9 on the Thomas Street. And these places, you put the pit stop in the corner. A lot of homeless, not only homeless, but drug addicts and whores and all sorts of people, they just use the whole bathroom, the whole street as a bathroom. They defecate on my steps, right by the car, in the middle of the street. I call the police, I call the sanitation place, I call all the numbers that I could possibly get a hold of. And I never get a response. And right now, I'm parking right in front of my house. I just came back from work. And this is, like, there are about 15 homeless people right here. And then they just use this street as parking. What can you do about it?
Sure.
I'm a single woman.
No, thank you. I imagine a number of people in the city have similar situations. Jeff, you probably get, complaints like this. What do you? What's your typical response to someone like Marta dealing with this?
Yeah, I believe that she said she was around 7th in Natoma. Mm-hmm. Had a hard time. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're going to be opening up a navigation center in that neighborhood in March or so, hopefully a little bit earlier than that. Once we do that, we're really going to focus that navigation center on that neighborhood. So we're going to be going out and talking to everybody in that neighborhood, taking a census, if you will, of folks in Western Soma who are currently not housed, and then working to get all of those folks indoors and help them find a pathway to something better than being out on the streets and disrupting lives for folks like Marta and others. These folks don't want to be out there. You know, they'd rather be indoors, and we're working as hard and as fast as we can to create more safe spaces, and are looking forward to opening up this navigation center to serve not only the homeless people in that neighborhood, but also the businesses and the visitors and the house folks.
Mm-hmm. So we've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to let each of you just kind of weigh in with some final thoughts about what you think ought to be done. And Matthew Doherty, maybe I should start with you from the nationwide perspective. But before you give your sort of concluding thoughts here, I want to just ask if there are any sort of role model cities around the country that you think a city like San Francisco might be able to learn from. And then in addition, we'd love to hear your sort of recommended action for a place like San Francisco on this problem.
Sure, and I always hesitate to name role model cities because every city is struggling with a lot of the same issues, but we do see some places, including Houston, Texas, who have been very much on the path that the framework that Jeff talked about earlier is putting San Francisco on, to a really coordinated system, aligning their resources, scaling up the gaps within their system so that they had more opportunities to provide to people, and they've seen remarkable progress on their numbers. We've seen places like New Orleans make really substantial progress. But I think we really need to take the lesson on veteran homelessness, where we scaled up the investments and communities of all sizes were able to make dramatic progress on homelessness.
And Jeff Kaczynski, real quick, your concluding thoughts on what needs to be done?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of work that can be that needs to be done, and our strategic framework really lays that out. It's available on our website, and actually some of the folks who worked on the architects of the changes made in Houston actually helped advise us as we were developing our strategic framework. But to the folks who are out in the audience, I would want to just remind everybody that, you know, the people on the streets, they were somebody's son and somebody's daughter, that they are our brothers and our sisters, and they don't want to be out there. And I ask that one of the things that we all need to do is to engage with these folks, to say hello to them, to remember that they are our neighbors, and that to not look past them but to look at them. Because when our homeless outreach team gets called and we have to go out and engage with folks because they're being disruptive in a neighborhood or they need help and they haven't spoken to another human being for months and months and months, it makes it a lot harder for them to be trusting and engaged. And when people feel loved and cared for and part of the community, it's much easier for us to do our work.
Mm-hmm. And Del Seymour, final thoughts very quickly.
Okay. Yeah. Everyone who's listened to this radio broadcast has a homeless person somewhere in their family. So I ask you tonight, go get them. Go bring them home. Bring them home. If everyone brought a homeless person home that's in their family, we would have an end to homelessness coming real quick. You may want to change your password and hide your iPad, but bring them home.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you for those concluding thoughts. That's City Visions for this evening. We're going to have to leave the conversation there. Our guests tonight were Jeff Kaczynski, Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City of San Francisco, Matthew Doherty, Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and Del Seymour, founder of the job readiness program Code Tenderloin. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show is produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week as we discuss the tragic fires up in the wine country here in the San Francisco Bay Area and how we can rebuild sustainable, fire-resistant communities in the North Bay. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.